Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Pick a date and sign up for a wading trip from Jesse Brown's. Our experienced guides meet you streamside with everything provided for the day. Rod and reel? Check. Waders and boots? Check. Flies and lunch? No, not together, but flies to fish with are included in a streamside lunch too. Let's learn to fly fish with Jesse Brown's. Bill Barty, your host of the Carolina Outdoors, where we celebrate things happen across the Carolinas outdoor-wise. Talk to people making outdoor things happen. We're glad that you're joining us, whether you're listening to us early on a Saturday morning as we blast up and down the eastern seaboard via the airwaves of WBT Radio, or maybe you're listening to us via podcast. Highlights of the Carolina Outdoors, available all over the place, including jessebrowns.com. Head over there and take a listen. You can listen to these segments, plus ones we have done in the past. What's happening here in the Carolinas? Things to note. Turkey season is wide open. Hunters are reporting seeing a good many birds out and about. And although we've had some rain this turkey season, it's been off to a good start in both Carolinas. It's also a busy time in the mountains. Trout season is open and happening, and area lakes have boats going on. The weather is warming up, and that puts more and more and more of us on area lakes. As that continues here on the Carolina Outdoors, we will be coming on reminding you about boat safety, etiquette, how to be safe on these area lakes. Hey, also the coast. We don't want to leave out the coast. That's been an exciting place too. But one of the hot spots, let's go up to Weldon, North Carolina. The Striper Run is in effect there on the Roanoke River. So many anglers are going to be going up there from now, really, mid-April into mid-May for that Striper Run, which is started off with a shad run before the stripers are heading up. Of course, the stripers like to eat that shad, and so following them is a big thing. A lot of different anglers will be out there, including our friends with fly rods. The thing about striper fishing on the Roanoke River is the ability to catch a lot of fish. Oftentimes the way it works, especially as the weather warms up, is the fishing will be good in the morning when the sun gets straight up, kind of that lunch to mid-afternoon. It may slow down a little bit, but then as the sun starts going back down, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, the fishing will just keep on getting better. So that's a little bit of what's happening with striper fishing. It's springtime in the Carolinas, and we're celebrating that. One of the things that's going on is the Urban Hike. You're invited to go on that. It is April 23rd. That's a Sunday, 1 o'clock start time. We're meeting at the Fair Meadow Swim Club. We do have guides available. You can go to Highlights of the Carolina Outdoors to hear Drew Thrasher talk about this. Again, April 23rd, Sunday at 1 o'clock. Jesse Browns is also going to be on hand at the Whitewater Center. Tuck Fest is going to be going on, including Earth Day, which is April 22nd. This edition of the Carolina Outdoors, we're going to have a lot of storytellers on here. Helen S. Hosley is going to come on to the program, as well as Russ Van Buren. We're talking about Storytellers Night at Jesse Brown's, April 27th, 6 o'clock start time. We hope you can come. We hope you enjoy this edition of the Carolina Outdoors. We want to see you. How about at Jesse Brown's Outdoors Facebook page, maybe Instagram? Both operate under the handle Jesse Brown CLT, and we want to see your hike, hunt, fish, climb, travel picks. We love to share and hope that you do too. Plus, giveaways, discounts, and celebrating our friends is a part of the charm. Again, Facebook and Instagram at Jesse Brown's CLT. Bill Barty, your host here on the Carolina Outdoors. Come on in. The listening is fine. The Carolina Outdoors is now in session. And as everyone knows, we like to talk about the outdoor adventures that are available here in the Carolinas and beyond. In fact, around the globe. And part of that celebration gives us the opportunity to talk to people that are making outdoor things happen. And that's what we do at Storytellers Night at Jesse Brown's Come Hear a Neighbor's Adventure. And many of these stories are adventure-oriented. Many times they are life experiences, they are travel, they are exploration, they are challenges, obstacles. They make us laugh, they make us cry, but nonetheless, they're always personal. And our next guest here on the Carolina Outdoors is just like that. She grew up in a small town in northern New York, but went from that small town to a life of adventure and travel and authorship, because she wrote a book about it, Do I Get to Wear That Neat Hat? And that's the title of her story, That Neat Hat. Join me in welcoming Helen Hosley to the Carolina Outdoors. Helen, welcome.
Well, thank you, Bill. It's really a pleasure to be with you today.
Well, we're grateful for you being on with us, and we're really grateful for you being on hand at Storytellers Night. That is April 27th, starting at 6 o'clock. And Helen, you're going to tell us your story or a part of your story, and we're looking forward to talking to you now about a bit of a preview of that. Tell us about your background. I mentioned you grew up in northern New York. Tell us about Helen Hosley growing up.
Yeah, Helen Hosley growing up, my full name is Helen Siskavich Hosley, so I am Lithuanian. My grandparents immigrated to the United States in the early 1900s, so I'm the second generation here. And we, in the Adirondacks, a very small mining town called Lion Mountain, New York, and it was known for its iron ore. And by the time I was born in the 1960s, the iron ore company was on its decline. And, there wasn't a whole lot for us kids to do. So we were outside all the time, whether we were playing baseball or out exploring the woods that were near our house. So for me to make the jump from, a youngster and then eventually as an adult into the National Park Service, I took to it like a duck to water, really.
Well, and I want to ask you about that because, and per the title of your story and your book, the National Park Service, your career there. But before you joined the National Park Service, you went on a 7-month adventure trip. And I guess that was in the late 1980s. Tell us how that came about, because that's a big deal to kind of drop everything and just take off on adventure.
Yeah, actually, growing up in those Adirondack Mountains, I realized that there was more to life than just in the Adirondacks, as beautiful as they are. And I always dreamed of skiing the Rocky Mountains. And so when I became a young adult, I quit my full-time job. I worked for Marriott when I got out of college and got really tired of working the 70 and 80 hours a week in a food service venue. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to do it. I quit the job. I found a friend who would be willing to travel with me. So we embarked on a 7-month journey that started in November of 1989 to zigzag down the Rocky Mountains and ski all the places that I dreamed about and what my friend Ginger dreamed about. So we hit, I can't remember how many places. I can say that we zigzagged from Banff, Canada, all the way down to Taos, New Mexico, and hitting all the beautiful, ski areas that one could encounter through Montana and Wyoming and Utah and Colorado and New Mexico. And then when it got too warm to ski, we basically put our skis on top of the car, and then we started hiking in national parks. And then in the interim, I heard from the National Park Service, I applied, like in January of 1990, a mutual friend of Ginger and mine was a national park ranger. He's a geologist in Yellowstone, and I was there at the time, and he said, hey, I have an extra application. Why don't you fill it out? And since I was traveling and had a whole bunch of time in my hands, I'm like, sure, I'll fill it out. And, you know, 4 months later, I get this phone call, or I call my parents, and my mother says, oh, there's this man who wants to give you a job. And I said, what do you mean someone wants to give me a job? I've been traveling. Who in the world would know where I am? Totally forgetting that I applied. And sure enough, it was Glen Canyon Recreation Area, gentleman by the name of Dan Han, who was the supervisor of the Interpretive Ranger Program there, said, well, we got your application, and we'd like to offer you an summer seasonal position here at Glen Canyon. And for me, I had no idea where it was. I knew it was in Arizona and Utah somewhere, and at the time I was in New Mexico, and I quickly got out my map in the days before GPS and everything at your fingertips and your phone. And I said, oh yeah, I'm over in Taos. I can be over in, you know, at Glen Canyon in the Page area in the next day or so. And I dropped off my stuff and talked with Dan. And, you know, he asked me over the phone though, he said, you know, he gave me a little bit of background as to what an interpretive ranger did, because I really didn't have a clue. My background and degree is in hotel restaurant management. And so he said, well, you know, you'll be mostly working at the visitor center. You'll be telling people where the bathrooms are. You'll do a little campfire interpretation, you know, stories about the area. And I said, well, I have two main questions. Number one, am I going to be working with food at all? And he kind of like took him aback, and he's like, well, no, you won't be. And he says, unless you go around the campground to drum up some business, and you know, you can ask people for some food type of thing, tongue in cheek, of course. And I said, okay, well then here's the deal breaker. I said, do I get to wear that neat hat? And he says, you absolutely do, and you'll get to own one when you're finished. And I said, okay, you have yourself a ranger for the summer. And that that one phone call literally changed my life, because it was like I found my calling with the National Park Service. It was, you know, fit me so well. My love of the outdoors, my gift of gab, if you will, and, you know, just being out with people and love of studying nature and history and all those things that, you know, people envision as a national park ranger. They think, oh, what a great job. And you know what? It really is a great job.
Well, it is one of the most demanded jobs out there, with a long list of people who just want to get into the system. Because once they're in the national park system, you know how that works. You can work a job and then hope to go to other places that maybe you want to work as you transfer around in the National Park Service if desired. If you're just joining us, the voice you hear there is Helen S. Hosley. She's the author of Do I Get to Wear That Neat Hat? She's also one of the storytellers at Storytellers Night at Jesse Brown's on April 27th, starting at 6 p.m. You are all invited. And Helen, to catch everyone up, and then I'm going to ask you some questions about what you just covered, because a young girl growing up in northern New York, then you are zigzag skiing across the Rocky Mountains in some wonderful snow, I'm sure. And then you land a job at Glen Canyon National Rec Area in Utah, which is essentially the desert. How did those challenges and those new adventures along the way from you know, skiing on a 7-month epic trip to then landing a job in the desert, talk to us about the challenges of that particular adventure and what you had to go through to learn the ways of not only the desert, but also dealing with people as a ranger.
Well, yeah, thank you. That's a really interesting question that you asked, and I'm so glad you asked it, because, you know, when you think about becoming a national park ranger, when you are successful, you know, you think, oh, automatically, you know, all these great traits, and you do have, you know, good skills. Otherwise they wouldn't have, you know, the government wouldn't have hired you. But ultimately, since I'm from the East Coast and the desert was a foreign environment to me, I had to learn how to survive in the desert,
right?
Because of the, you know, the completely different climate, the lack of water, you know, so I very quickly learned that I didn't go anywhere any day without at least a gallon of water with me. You know, so that's basic rule number one, survive in the desert, you know, water is king. And you know, and then not only that, but then looking at the different landscape. And when you're out on a trail in the desert, you're looking for different clues in order to stay on a trail. You know, in the right. in the Adirondacks, you have, you know, either some paint on a tree or some type of, you know, landscape markings, that type of thing, landscape tape markings. But in the desert, it's like you have cairns, right? And you know, rocks piled upon rocks, because you have certainly plenty of rock out there. And, you know, so it's the little things that was an adjustment for me, in addition to, learning about the entire area and figuring out what was going to be my expression as a national park ranger, other than, you know, being, you know, polite to the people that come in to the visitor center or who are launching their boats onto Lake Powell. But mm-hmm. what was it I was interested in? You know, was I interested in the peoples that came before us? Was I interested in, you know, the flora and the fauna? And so I had the opportunity while I was there for the season to really study the area and get to know it more than just a pass-through. And I came to love the desert. I always thought, as a mountain girl, that I'd be like, oh, my God, I could never live in the desert. But I thoroughly enjoyed living there when I was a ranger. It was just a lifetime experience and special, really special.
Well, and fittingly that you could not live there but loved being there, that was a reminder to everyone listening. That was a seasonal assignment. And when that ended, you went from the desert to what many would say is the headquarters of the National Park Service, Washington, D.C. So you went to the big stage as a ranger there on the National Mall. What about that adventure, being a ranger there?
Yes. Well, you don't really think of having National Park Rangers in an urban setting, but the fact of the matter is there are, you know, Boston, New York, Washington, D.C. for certain, they do have National Park Rangers, because there's a lot of National Park sites about our historical heritage. And what was really striking to me when I became a ranger on the National Mall was the level of interpretation that I had to up my game. Right. Because when you're out west, this is my humble opinion. Others rangers might say something else, but when you're out west and you have these beautiful vistas you're looking out over, right, and the sun is setting on these gorgeous orange rocks, and it's just breathtaking. So it's easier to be an interpretive ranger there, right? And one of the comments that one of the seasonal rangers made, I think the first or second day I was going through my orientation at Glen Canyon, because they were bemoaning the fact that they were at a recreation area as opposed to a full national park like Grand Canyon or Yosemite, Yellowstone. And they said, well, at least we're not, you know, at the Washington Monument in D.C. And, you know, and I didn't really have much of a reference, right? I was just like, okay, whatever. Whenever you're upset that you're not at a national park, I'm just happy to not be in a kitchen. And so when I got to the National Mall, and I have a love of history, it was like a kid in a candy store, because you have your pick of everything from, early Native American to, Revolutionary War times to present day politics. And you really have to paint your picture with words as opposed to just those beautiful vistas. And so I found the challenge of being a ranger, yes, in the Washington Monument, when you have only 60 seconds to deliver a message to an elevator full of people about what they're going to see at the very top, that's extremely challenging, as opposed to you have 2 hours to talk about dinosaurs in Glen Canyon.
One thing we left out along the way, again, a 7-month skiing and adventure trip, followed by an unexpected job from an application that was put in to enjoying the challenges and time in the desert before heading to Washington, D.C. But Helen, you were also smitten somewhere in here where you fell in love, which just added to the adventure as well. Do you want to tell us about that?
Well, I'd like to say when people ask me what my book is about, I say it's a love story. And there's a love story on many levels. The first one is my love of skiing and the love of the outdoors. And so that's the first part of my book and talking about all the places that Ginger and I skied and the adventures that went along with that, to, you know, discovering my love of the national parks. And then when I was a ranger on the National Mall, within 2 months of me starting working, there was another young man that came and to be a temporary ranger. So there was different statuses, of course, within the national parks. You have seasonal, temporary, and permanent status. And I was a temporary, and so John came as a temporary. And like I said, within 2 months, I laid eyes on him, and I fell in love with the man. We went on our first date, and in May of 1991, he proposed to me in July, and we got married in February of 92, and last month, we celebrated our 31st anniversary.
And the rest, as they say, is history. And,
that's right. That's right.
And we're going to get to meet you in person at Storytellers Night at Jesse Brown's Come Here, A Neighbor's Adventure. Helen S. Hosley, That Neat Hat is her story. We'll find out how Ginger is. We'll find out what you're doing now, all on hand Thursday, April 27th, starting at 6 o'clock at Jesse Brown's Outdoors. Helen, thank you so much for joining us here on the Carolina Outdoors.
You're absolutely welcome, Bill. It's been a wonderful pleasure.
Well, we look forward to seeing you that night, April 27th, and hearing more, learning more, and celebrating your story more.
Look forward to that as well. Everyone have a great couple of weeks. We'll see you soon.
We're going to be back on the other side. You're listening to the Carolina Outdoors. Join us for the Urban Hike on Sunday, April 23rd at 1 p.m. at the Fair Meadows Swim Club in the South Park area. We'll take a 7.7-mile guided journey and see parts of Charlotte that you've never seen. Sponsored by our friends over at Jesse Brown's and jessebrowns.com, all you need is a water bottle and comfy shoes, and you can get both with discount code HIKE25 at jessebrowns.com to save $25 on your $100 Jesse Brown's purchase. We're saddling up this pony called the Carolina Outdoors for a nice ride along the way. Bill Barty, your host. We talk about all the outdoor things that are going on in the Carolinas and beyond the borders of the Carolinas, but we also talk to people that are making news and influencing the outdoors and influencing us that enjoy the outdoors. Oftentimes here on the Carolina Outdoors, the adventures that we talk about are adventures that we have chosen ourselves, but sometimes we do not get to choose the adventure. It is chosen for us, the circumstance, if you will. And almost everyone on the planet over the age of 30 remembers where they were on September 11th, 2001. That was the day that horrific terror attack took the lives of over 3,000 people at the World Trade Center, as well as in Pennsylvania and Washington, D.C. Our next guest remembers. Russ Van Buren's going to join us. He was a witness to the attack at the World Trade Center, and he had an upfront seat to the collapse of the towers. Russ, welcome to the Carolina Outdoors.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you very much.
It's great to have you. Of course, you're going to be on hand with us April 27th, Storytellers Night at Jesse Brown's Come Hear a Neighbor's Adventure. And as I said in that open, Russ, sometimes we don't get to choose our adventures. This one definitely wasn't chosen for you, and it's been with you for the past 22 years. But tell our listeners here, what put you in New York City on that, what started out as a beautiful September day ended up in turning into a nightmare.
And Bill, you said it very succinctly. It was a beautiful day. And I'll tell a little bit more about why I was there, but it was also going to be a great business day. And we walked that morning from Midtown down 8th Avenue, had a little breakfast, took a cab, and we're leisurely because it was just so beautiful. Of course, what you don't think about is exactly what you're saying. We don't always get to pick, you know, our events, but, you know, any moment, at any time in our lives, there's a possibility that there will be an event that will be life-changing. And this was for me. I was working those days for GE Lighting, living in Charlotte, North Carolina. I went to Wake Forest University and married a Carolina girl, and so stayed. And I was actually commuting to New York in those days, and I was the property management market segment manager for GE Lighting at the time. And we were working on large commercial properties, and we were doing business with a family in Manhattan called the Silversteins, and they had just bought the lease rights to the World Trade Center. Oh. And so we were there to, we were doing business with the Silversteins already, so we were there, and we had salespeople and marketing people and distribution folks, and then, of course, the property managers themselves. It was to be a big day where we introduce everybody. I would say that the one thing that was succinct about that moment, you ask yourself why. You ask yourself a lot of why questions after a traumatic event. And we had a young salesman, a guy named Patrick Ronan, who's still alive today and is battling cancer, that was with me. And so I decided to go to the distribution office instead of the South Tower, which where the other folks we were all working with went to South Tower. And we were actually there when the first plane hit. And so that's what we were doing there at the time.
Well, of course, we know how that story goes. One plane hits, a second plane hits, and then the collapse of those towers, and powerless, helpless, hopeless. Those are the emotions that we all felt that day. But Russ, you even more so. Take us beyond that day. How you handle that, I guess, emotional scarring. I'm no psychologist and can't speak on PTSD that much, except that it is a thing. Repressed memories. Take us beyond September 11th after you got out of, or tell us, how did you get out of there and then what happened afterwards?
And that's just very well said, Bill, and I appreciate that. And I'll tell you exactly where we were when we were having a meeting about a block away. Somebody came in and said there's a fire at the World Trade Center. And we all sat back down and continued to meet. And then they came in and said it was an airplane. So we were on the opposite side of the North Tower, on the other side of the South Tower. And the first tower to get hit was the North Tower. And so we were trying to call teammates, and we were obviously cell phones weren't working. So me and Patrick, we actually walked down to outside the South Tower. And, of course, it was completely chaotic on the streets. And the firemen and the policemen were trying to get us to leave as they were trying to get everybody to evacuate. Of course, we were skirting the building because we were, like I said, we were trying to contact teammates when the plane came over our heads and actually hit the South Tower. Mm-hmm. And if you ever have a moment in your life that just everything changes, it's like that moment. And I just couldn't believe what I was seeing and was feeling. And it was not long after that the building came down, and we were very close and we got caught up in the rubble. But we were in a safe spot, and there was obviously lots of noise and vibration, more than you can possibly imagine. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing in me that I could possibly describe the emotion that I was feeling through all that. And then the firemen really kind of, it went from a lot of noise and confusion and a lot of vibration to dead silence. And very quickly, the firemen were there and had moved us to walk up the West Side Highway. And we actually walked back to our hotel from there. I'll never look at a first responder the same again. And I can't help but stopping them on the street or a grocery store or wherever I see them and just tell them how much I appreciate that they're there.
Well, and that's well said. And if you're just joining us here on the Carolina Outdoors, we're talking Storytellers Night at Jesse Brown's. Rise from Collapse. Russ Van Buren, who is our guest here on the Carolina Outdoors, is previewing his story. And Russ, you're a reader, you love music, but you're a people watcher. An observer of humans is the way it's described. What did you see in humanity that day? And then we're going to talk about the healing after that day.
There's just so many amazing stories to tell, and I would say that what I observed with people and how it changed is there were people that were virtually lost, mm-hmm. didn't know what to do, and they would come up to you on the street and ask, "What should I do?" And it would be a simple conversation of like, "Well, you should go home." And they're like, "Well, there's no cabs, there's nothing running." And then they say, "Well, where do you live?" "I live in Chinatown." "How far is that?" "2 miles." "Why don't you walk?" "I should walk home." And then say, "Yep, that's what you need to walk home." And they would shake your hand and thank you. That happened over and over, Bill, and it got a weird thought in my head that, you know, I don't really know what I'm doing right now.
Right.
But I carry a to-do list. And I pulled a to-do list out of my pocket and looked at it, and there was nothing important on it. Not one thing. Running my day every day, day after day, by this list. And there's nothing important on that list. That was a big aha. And like I said, there was many, many life lessons. The kindness that was going on, the people helping each other, strangers on the street hugging you, you know, and maybe metaphorically, we're all gray. There's no black, there's no white, we're all gray. We've all been through the same experience. We're all exactly the same. We'll see another thing that I observed with folks at that.
So, Russ, we're going to leave that September day now and fast forward. And, of course, you were there. You saw this. You lived this. You repressed a lot of it and held it in. Take us ahead 5 years, 10 years, and how you healed from it, who helped you heal, and some of the challenges that you had along the way as you were seeking that solace and healing.
Yeah, that's just a really terrific question. And it was very clear early on. I said I was fine when I was not fine. And there was signs of that. But, you know, I joked with friends and family, the only kind of therapy I ever did was tequila therapy. But the bottom line is you go through a trauma, and there's all kinds of traumas. You know, all kinds of child abuse, men coming back from war, being in a car wreck, domestic abuse. It's just endless of the traumas that we have.
Right.
And then it happens, and the trauma reveals its impact, and that leads you to have to deal with it. And healing can be positive or it can be negative. And it's a tremendous amount of energy in you. And so I probably did a little bit of all that, you know, negative and positive.
Mm-hmm.
But then through healing, what I would say is that it leads to life lessons. 7 significant life lessons for me on the day of 9/11, but I didn't know any of them until years later. But I'll give you an example of life. And it was roughly 10 years later, and I was virtually talking to nobody about the experience. And I was getting the oil change in my car at the dealership. And on the television in the little room where everybody's sitting waiting for their cars, a Cancer Fund for First Responders came on, and for 9/11 first responders. And I turned to the woman next to me and I said, "I was there when that happened." And she kind of nodded politely, and she raised her paper a little bit, right? Like, "I don't want to hear this." And then uncontrollably, I started telling her about the day. And she was visibly uncomfortable. Mm. Her husband shoot me dirty looks like, "Stop." My inner voice was, you know, saying to myself, "Dude, what are you doing? Well, you don't talk to anybody for 10 years, and now you're going to pour your heart out to this poor woman."
Yes.
And I was trying to stop myself. And they eventually said, "Mr. Van Buren, your car's ready." And I was like, "Oh, thank God." And I jumped up, and I'm practically running down the hall. And I hear this voice behind me, "Dude, dude." And I turn around. Comes a very large black guy, young. He runs down, grabs me, and hugs me. He sets me down. He's got tears in his eyes, and he says to me, "You have no idea what's going on in my life today, and you have no idea how badly I needed to hear that, what you had to say." And he said, "I remember that day, and after that happened, we were all on the same team. This entire country, we were all on the same team." And he said, "We're not right now." And he hugged me again. He said, "Love you, bless you."
Wow.
And I got in my car, and I tried to, you know, synthesize, process, asking myself, what just happened? And what happened, what was clear, revealed to me, you know, there's a life force, and you might call it the universe, you might call it evolution, you might call it the Tao, you might call it the Holy Spirit. There is something that moves through us that was very clear for me to see, and was moving through me. Now, I thought I was in charge of all this. I thought I was talking to this woman next to me. I never even looked at the gentleman across the room. And that gentleman needed to hear a message. And so that life force moved through me and spoke to him. And it was very eye-opening, and it's part of what led me know, as uncomfortable as this is for me, it is cathartic. I need to share this story. And I will tell you, thank you for letting me tell it right now, Bill, because it's a reminder of how far I've come.
Well, and that gives me an opportunity to jump in and remind people how Storytellers Night began. And if you're just joining us again, our guest here on the Carolina Outdoors is Russ Van Buren. He's going to be on hand at Jesse Brown's on Thursday, April 27th, to tell his story, Rise from Collapse, having to do with not only September 11th, 2001, but Russ's life since then. And Russ is not a performer. He is a friend, a client, a citizen of Charlotte. And that's how this all came about. Jesse Brown's has been outfitting people for adventures and celebrating their stories for the past 53 years. But for the past 10 years, we've been utilizing the storyteller stage at Jesse Brown's, where we can hear our neighbors talk about their life-changing events, adventures, and the change that has happened through that. It's one of our favorite times to get together with the community within the walls of this Charlotte outdoor store. So with that being said, the way the storytellers happen is they are nominated. Their name goes up on a board. And Russ, I'll let you jump in here because your name has been on our board waiting for the right time to contact you and invite you. Ask you really, and it happens out of the blue, if you will agree to stand up and tell your 20-minute or so story to the audience. And Russ, you were thinking about other things on a Friday, and then you got a call on a Saturday.
So, and I appreciate you setting it up like that, Bill, and that was really a story for you, but it's also a lesson on just really how this all works. I have a publisher because I publish fiction, and she is very smart. She put her hands on my latest fiction work that I'm trying to publish, and she said, "I'm not saying no to this, but you know, I'm hearing nonfiction every time I talk to you." She said there it would be valuable for people who've had a trauma that did not go to therapy to hear your story. I literally thought that was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever heard. I talked to a friend of mine who is a therapist, and she said, "No, I think it'd be valuable." And a nonfiction book goes along with speaking, and I had thought about this years ago and just said no and walked away from it. So I went and talked to the folks that can help you be more professional about this, and Anyways, I went home and on a Friday and said a little prayer. I said, you know, God, you gotta give me a little direction here. I need to know, and if this is a direction I should go. And Bill, I hadn't heard from you in 3 years, and that next morning I got a phone call from you. And I joked with you, it's like the old joke of, you know, a man sitting on the roof while it's flooding, and he prays to God for somebody to come help him, and a boat comes along, and he says, no, God's going to save me. And then a helicopter comes along, and he says, no, God's going to save me. And he drowns, and he goes to heaven, and he's like, God, I prayed to you. Why didn't you save me? And God's like, oh, you know, I sent you a boat and a helicopter. I don't know what else you need. So that kind of moment for me, Bill, and I, that call very directly was, okay, and this is uncomfortable for me. And right. There's a lot of reasons, and I have a lot of silent respect for the day and for the dead and for those that survived. And so there's many, many stories and many people who suffered a whole lot more than I have. And so that has been a barrier for me to talk about this openly. I don't want to trivialize it in any way.
Yes, and neither do we with the description of adventure. And as we said it before, many times we do not get to pick our adventure, and this one was not light, but it is a gift. And Russ Van Buren, you're giving us the gift of your story. That's part of what makes it powerful, is because it is so personal. And we look forward to having you there Thursday, April 27th. Come hear a neighbor's adventure at Jesse Brown's Outdoors starting at 6 o'clock. Russ Van Buren, thank you so much for your time here on the Carolina Outdoors.
Absolutely. Thank you, Bill.
We're going to take a quick break, come back on the other side, and wrap up this edition. I'm Bill Barty. Storyteller Night at Jesse Brown's has become a wonderful tradition at Jesse Brown's Outdoors. Three different friends, clients, neighbors have agreed to stand up and tell their adventure, life experience, life change story to us. Each have 20 minutes and the results are amazing. This April 27th is no different, with Roman Phillips with Beyond Eagle, Helen S. Hosley with That Neat Hat, and Russ Van Buren with Rise from Collapse. The price to attend is free, and you're invited to Jesse Brown's. More info at jessebrowns.com. Hey, the sponsors of Storytellers Night at Jesse Brown is jessebrowns.com. Go over there and check out everything that we have going on at Jesse Brown's, as well as highlights of the Carolina Outdoors. You can check out those episodes, these episodes, a bunch of episodes all right there, as well as the event page. Again, jessebrowns.com. Special thanks to our guest this week on the Carolina Outdoors, Helen S. Hosley. That Neat Hat. She's going to be on hand at Storytellers Night Thursday, April 27th, starting at 6 o'clock, followed by Russ Van Buren, Rise from Collapse. Thanks to both of them for joining us on this edition of the Carolina Outdoors. We're excited to have them on hand. We're excited to have you on hand, and we're glad that you joined us for these episodes. Whether you're listening to us via the airwaves of WBT Radio as we blast up and down the Eastern Seaboard early on a Saturday morning, or maybe you're checking us out via podcast, Highlights of the Carolina Outdoors, we hope that you'll rate and review us if you like what you heard. It helps other people find Highlights of the Carolina Outdoors and helps us spread the good news of the outdoors. I'm Bill Barty. For TJ the DJ Boggs, make the Carolina Outdoors look a little bit better than you found it, and pick up your trash.